Well, David, I guess we should first start with Kelvin Herrera. A little bit of a scare last night, but it sounds like not much of a concern, right?
No, looks like it was just a temporary blip, one of those things that you kind of lose feeling and you get some numbness and it shoots up and down your arm a little bit and you think the world is about to end, and then it's gone a little while later, which is a nice feeling. You hope the Royals are being truthful, of course, because, one, you'd like there to be a reason why he all of a sudden just couldn't throw a strike, and, two, you'd like him to actually be healthy. And so if this is a real health concern, you'd like him to not be going out there feeling this every time, because we saw how his effectiveness dropped. And, you know, if he's not healthy, he should be on the DL. And you just hope that they aren't sugarcoating this, because they're missing Joaquin Soria already and there's not many bullpen options. I don't think they are. I think they'd be pretty careful with Herrera, but time will tell. Apparently he might be available this evening. Hopefully the Royals win by 10 or 12 runs. They don't have to worry about a closer, but yeah, we might find out if Herrera is available in, I don't know, about 6.5 hours or so.
If he is healthy, there's nothing wrong. He's good to go the rest of the season. Even with that being said, are there any concerns from him and what you've seen this year? Obviously, it's been well documented that it hasn't quite been the smoothest transition into the closer's role, but moving into the postseason, if the Royals are able to make it, what's your level of confidence that Herrera is going to be able to get the job done?
You know, even in his struggles, I've been pretty confident with Herrera, just because, for one, I'll come out and say this. I'm a Herrera apologist all the way. You know, I'm the guy who will defend Kelvin Herrera no matter what he does. Sometimes he's not everybody has their moments that you can't defend them. But I'm pretty confident in him, because, really, he's been pretty solid, except for a blip here, a blip there. And most of them have been in situations where, I don't know what this says about him as a player, but most of them in situations where the intensity wasn't as much as you typically get for a closer. We've seen him on the postseason stage. We've seen him dominate in the postseason. We've also seen him have a terrible at bat in the postseason, which I will never forget. But I think I watch that occasionally. It's always fun to see him.
Oh man, that's good stuff.
It's a disaster. But
how many at bats do you think he's taken in his life? Honestly.
In his life, since high school, maybe since he was a 16 or 17 year old, I would guess 15, and that might be a little high.
Maybe.
I mean, it didn't look like 15 in the 2014 World Series. It looked like it was his first at bat ever. But I'm confident in the guy. You know, he has a big fastball. I think he's kind of working out his slider and changeup issues that he's had at times this season. And for the most part, I mean, last night, even before he started feeling the effects of the forearm thing, he had retired the first two batters on four pitches and was getting in there 98, 99 miles per hour. He looked really good. And then I think something I don't know what happened exactly, but it happened after that third batter hit the triple that Melky Cabrera watched roll for a little while. And, yeah, I think that kind of doomed him. So as long as he's healthy, I'm confident in Herrera.
Well, and with the closer, when you're only pitching one inning at a time, the numbers can be inflated quite a bit, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you're throwing 60 innings a year and you give up three runs in two outings, I mean, right there, that's six runs over 60 innings, and you have a normal, the other 58 innings, you give up, I don't know, 10 runs, which is really good. Well, now you're almost at a 3 ERA just because of two bad outings the entire season. So it's hard to judge. ERA is a hard way to judge a reliever. The strikeouts are pretty much there. He's not walking a ton of people, although he has been recently, which is a little bit of a concern. But all in all, he's still a top 12 closer. He's just not what we're used to in Kansas City, because we've really, since, Joaquin Soria took over in 2008, aside from 2012 when Broxton was there, the Royals have had a top three closer for almost a decade. And so to drop to a top 11 closer, whatever it is, it's a little bit of a difference, but he's still very good.
We've got David Leske of Baseball Prospectus Kansas City joining us here on Rock Chalk Sports Talk, New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Royals had Salvador Perez last night back in the lineup after his stint on the DL. How would you characterize just how important he is to this team as they're trying to make this final push?
On a scale of 1 to 10, his importance is probably a 26. he's the guy, you know. He everything he does is what the Royals need from him right now. A middle-of-the-order bat, which he has been this season, and the time off might actually be beneficial for him offensively. He is really good at blocking pitches behind the plate when he doesn't get lazy, which does happen from time to time. He's got a cannon for an arm. He knows his pitching staff well. You know, I don't love the way he calls a game, if we're being honest.
What do you mean by that?
Pitching staff loves it. Well, I think he sticks with fastballs too often. He's not a very good pitch framer, and he's just not a great receiver. And I think that some issues the pitching staff has had over the last few seasons, when they have issues, is because he doesn't call. I don't think he calls great pitches, which the pitcher can shake off, but they trust him so much that it's one of those situations. You take the good with the bad, I guess, with Salvador Perez, and I think the bad is that I don't think he anticipates changing pitches too often well enough. But you know, all in all, and you saw it last night, he knew immediately that something was wrong with Kelvin Herrera. You saw him jump out of his crouch on that last batter before they pulled him, and then the next pitch he called the trainers out right away. Cam Gallagher doesn't know that, except for maybe with like Jake Junis. Drew Butera, well, he's been with the staff for a while. He doesn't catch the guys as much as Salvador Perez does, so he doesn't know it as well. And you know, then there's like this guy that's blocking pitches last night. I think the Royals probably would have lost that game if Drew Butera was behind the plate, because Salvador Perez is a better pitch blocker. And there was a runner on third, and he blocked like three pitches with the runner on third and two outs. So all of that, getting Perez back, it's huge. And then there's the chemistry aspect of it, and not that Perez wasn't with the team, but you get him back in the lineup, it's a jolt for everybody. So I think it's really big, and you know, if the Royals don't go on a run with Perez back, they're just not going to go on a run the rest of the year.
Was there anything this past weekend in that series against Cleveland that surprised you, or did it go about the way you expected it to?
No, I mean, I said in my preview, they'd lose 2 of 3, and they lost 2 of 3. You know, they've hit Salazar pretty well. A lot of the guys have hit him well, too. And so that didn't surprise me too much. I was a little bit surprised by the complete ineptitude on Saturday night offensively against Trevor Bauer. But, you know, the Indians are a better team than the Royals, honestly. And so for them to take 2 of 3 and did it convincingly in the first two games, not surprising at all. But the good news is, just because the Indians are a better team than the Royals, and they are, doesn't mean the Royals can't still win the division. It's a really tall task, but yeah, nothing really shocked me. It was just kind of, this is what I thought would happen, and then sure enough, it played out the exact way I thought it would.
So, I mean, at this point, you kind of mentioned it there, but you've kind of got to concede that Cleveland's going to win this division, right?
In all likelihood, yeah. So I was actually really just thinking about this a few minutes ago, and if the Royals end the weekend after they play Cleveland in Cleveland for three games, if they end the weekend more than four games out, I think that while mathematically they may still be alive, they're done. The division is not possible. They'd be more than four games out with three left to play against Cleveland and, 33 games left the season. That's a really tough task. It's a difficult wall to climb. If they can get out of the weekend at three games out or less, or fewer, I guess, would be the grammatically correct way to say that. If they can get out of that weekend in that shape, then it's anybody's game. So, you know, we'll know a lot more, and I keep saying this every week, but we'll know a lot more on Sunday evening than we do today. If they're the only number of games out that I'd look at and go, I guess they still have a shot, it's not great, is four. If they're four games out, I still don't really know. But three or fewer, and I think they're in it, five or more, and they're out of it, and you know, we'll have a good idea. That the good news for the Royals is, as injury-ridden as they've been, the Indians have kind of been worse. I mean, they put Kipnis on the DL today, Andrew Miller and Danny Salazar yesterday or 2 days ago. I mean, it's been a rough go for Cleveland, too. So maybe they'll falter with their guys out, but there's a really good team. And the Royals are really average to slightly above average team. So it's tough for them being as far out as they are.
Well, whether or not you're looking at winning the division or going for a wild card spot, sure, it affects us, people watching from the outside, scoreboard watching, trying to figure out what it's going to take to get there. Internally, whether or not they're in the mix for the AL Central or just the wild card, does it change anything for them?
Not really, not yet at least, because, you know, they just have to win games. It doesn't really matter how or who they beat as long as they're beating the teams they're playing. And basically they have to get to probably 85 wins, probably safely gets them into the postseason as a wild card. And I think it would be 89 or 90 to win the division, which is really difficult with 63 wins and 38 to play. So it's just about winning games. Where it does change things is if it gets to that last 10, 12 days of the season and it looks like, okay, this is a wild card team, they might want to do some shuffling of their rotation so that they could get probably Danny Duffy to start the wild card game. But, you know, until then, at this point, there's not much of a difference. As we get deeper into September, then they'll start to kind of change their strategies to prepare maybe for that play-in game that we've all seen, and it can be crazy.
Leski, Baseball Prospectus, Kansas City. I'm Nick Schwert, and this is Rock Chalk Sports Talk, new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Minnesota is really just kind of a pain in the ass, aren't they? Because all season long, I've been operating under the assumption like, oh, eventually they'll go away. Eventually they're going to get out of the way, and it's just going to be the Royals and the Indians at the top of that division. But here they stand, 65-60. What is going on with that organization and that team this year?
I don't know. I mean, it's weird because they have a really nice base of young talent. And I think in the relatively near future, I think they will be a very good team. I don't understand why they're good right now. It doesn't make any sense to me. They traded for Jaime Garcia and then traded him away after one start because they realized they were out of the race. They traded away their closer, Brandon Kinsler. Their bullpen, even with Kinsler, has been really bad. They've allowed way more runs than they've scored. They don't look like a good team on paper at all. They have some nice offensive pieces. Miguel Sano, who, by the way, also on the disabled list, he's a fantastic hitter. We know that. Joe Mauer is a professional hitter. Byron Buxton's been fantastic over the last month or so. Eddie Rosario, Max Kepler, the hits. I didn't even mention Brian Dozier, who just single-handedly destroyed the Royals last season. But they can't pitch. And I don't understand how they're staying in this race with Bartolo Colon taking the ball every fifth day. It just doesn't make any sense to me. I'm convinced that their bullpen just isn't good enough to hold up down the stretch. Now, they've got a little wiggle room because they're five games over and they're a half game up in the wild card, I think. So you never know, but I'm not terribly worried about the Twins. Royals have, what, seven games left against them? They're a game and a half back. I would be surprised if the Royals don't go 5-2 or better, honestly. I think the Royals are better than the Twins. I know the records don't say it, but when the Royals are firing on all cylinders, they are a 95-win team. That doesn't mean they're going to win 95 games, of course, but they're that good. When the Twins are firing on all cylinders, they're like an 85-win team. And so the Royals can get on track, which I think they will with Perez back. I mean, they're significantly better than Minnesota. I'm not worried about them, but at the same time, I've been worried about them all year. And here we are, what, August 23rd, they're a game and a half ahead of the Royals. So maybe I'm just stupid, but I don't get it, and I don't see it continuing.
Well, I mean, there are, what, six teams within, I think, 4.5 games of that second wildcard spot, including the Royals. Like, how many teams are legitimately in the mix, and how many teams do you think will be in the mix come the end of the regular season?
Well, I mean, it's Twins, Angels, Royals for sure. And the Mariners are right up there. The Rangers are right up there. They're the only team with a positive run differential. I feel like I'm missing somebody. Who am I missing?
Tampa Bay's four games out. Baltimore's 4.5 out.
Right, yeah. Baltimore, I don't trust because their pitching is just terrible.
Yeah.
But Tampa Bay, I mean, they've got good starting pitching and they've got a good defense, especially with Kiermaier back. So they're in it. I mean, there's five or six teams who are a hot week away from being the front runner. I mean, really, that's what it comes down to. And it's such a close race that if the Royals can pull off a 12 of 15 or something, I mean, they're going to be up by four games, and it's going to be a walk in the park to the playoffs, to the wild card game, probably in Yankee Stadium. Although I don't completely trust the Yankees to hold on to that top wild card spot either, so that's in play too. I mean, there's a lot of possibilities that come from the American League being just like a cesspool of mediocrity.
So, I mean, I ask you this almost every week, and I know it may seem a bit redundant, but with how many teams are in the mix, I think it's still pertinent to ask every week, how do you feel about the Royals and their chances with these next, 38 games or so?
Yeah, I mean, the problem with the Royals, we've talked about this, any given day, we have no idea what they're going to look like. They can look like a World Series champion, or they can look like a team that should pick first overall. You know, it doesn't, there's no rhyme or reason to this team, but I think they have as good a chance as anybody. You know, every team, if you look at all these teams that are in the race, they all have some pretty significant flaws. The Royals, I think, are the best position to overcome their flaws, because right now the biggest flaw is their bullpen, which is weird for us to say after all these years of a great bullpen. But keep in mind, it was like 3 weeks ago that they ended like a 33-inning scoreless stretch or something out of the bullpen. So while the bullpen has struggled mightily in the last 2, 3, 4 weeks, they have shown they can be dominant over a decent stretch of time. So I think that they are the team that is most likely to overcome their faults, but doesn't mean they will. And other teams too. The Angels have Mike Trout. That helps to mask a whole lot. The Mariners have Robinson Cano and Nelson Cruz. That masks a lot as well. And you know, there are positive attributes on every team as well. And I mean, I feel like the Royals have a good shot, but I don't. With all these teams, I mean, you'd be silly to take the Royals over the field, because there's just so many options.
He's David Leske. I'm Nick Schwartz, New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Before I let you go, I want you to make a prediction. When is Moustakas going to hit number 36? Or you could be really bold and just say he goes on like the coldest streak ever and doesn't get it this year. Wouldn't that be, honestly, wouldn't that be like just so fitting for that home run curse that Mike Moustakas gets 35 with 40 to go? And he never hits 36.
And then just doesn't hit one.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he's going to do it. I'm going to be really bold. I think he gets 36 tonight.
Wow.
And 37 tomorrow.
Okay.
And as I say that, he's taking batting practice and he's torn both knee ligaments. and his right arm has just completely fallen off. I think the Rockies pitching the next 2 days is not as strong as John Gray, although I thought he had a good shot against Gray with the way Gray throws. But I think he gets 36 tonight and 37 tomorrow, and then we can say bye-bye Balboni forever.
Yeah, we'll never reference that name again. Like, only when talking about Mike Moustakas hitting 36 and 37.
Well, next year when Jorge Soler hits 36, they'll say, oh, he tied Balboni for the second most home runs in Royals history.
What do you think the reaction's going to be? Because it's, I mean, if we're being honest, like, it's a cool number. It'd be a really cool moment, but It's not super important. It's just something that, like, it's almost like a something you just want to get off your back, is just to get that number out of the way, have somebody from this era break it. But what do you think the reaction is going to be if he's lucky enough to do it at Kauffman Stadium?
Oh, I think it's going to be huge, because I think the number's embarrassing to Royals fans.
Absolutely.
And it should be.
Yeah.
And I think that there's some symmetry to this. Is the end of this run. I mean, this season, no matter what happens, at least a couple guys are going to be gone. Even if they can re-sign a couple, there's going to be multiple players hitting the road and playing in different uniforms next season. And there's a lot of symmetry to Dayton Moore's first draft pick, because, remember, he said he had nothing to do with the 2006 draft, which I still don't believe, but that's the official record, so we'll go with that. Mike Moustakas is Dayton Moore's first draft pick, and he brought a World Series to Kansas City. He brought a World Series title to Kansas City. The city saw an All-Star game during this Coors run. And then, to top it all off, the most embarrassing record in team history is broken by Dayton Moore's very first draft pick. So I think there's a lot of symmetry there. I think it's really cool. And I think on top of that, it gets a really embarrassing monkey off their back. And so I think it's going to be whenever he breaks it, if he does it in Kansas City, I think it's going to be really electric.
I do too. I hope you're right. If you are right, I will absolutely give you credit. If he hits 36 tonight, I'm going to go crazy for you personally, because that'll be a big
Thank
moment.
Thank you. It's my record. If that happens,
that's right.
I should be in the record books.
I hope so. Well, hopefully you're right. Thank you once again for joining me, David, and we'll do it again next week.
Sounds good. Thanks, Nick.
This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
Quarter till four, new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. With Derek Johnson, I'm Nick Schwert. It's Rock Chalk Sports Talk. Mitch Holtis, the voice of the Chiefs, coming up at 4:15. We'll talk to Jesse Newell of the KC Star at the top of the 5 o'clock hour. But right now, it's time for another edition of the most self-explanatory segment in the history of sports talk radio. It's time for Let's Rank Stuff. And today, we will be examining the best and worst ways to cheat in sports. We've never gone this way. This is probably going to be some of the hottest, some of the most daring stuff that we've ever done on this segment. But that's why we do it. We do it to go places nobody else dares to go. So let's go ahead and get it going. Let's start with the worst. The worst ways to cheat in sports. Number five, the fifth worst way to cheat in sports is to have a hitman break the legs of your rival competitor. Mm. Now, there's really only one...
It's like you're pointing someone out.
There's really only one notable example of this happening, and that would be the Tonya Harding-Nancy Kerrigan incident. Can you imagine if she would have gotten away with that? If the hitman would have just ran out, nobody would have figured out who it was, and then Tonya Harding just went on to win gold, and nobody was the wiser.
Are you surprised at all? Like, nobody's ever done that?
Like you see, since then?
Yeah.
Well, the first example of it happening didn't work out very well, Derek.
Well, yeah, but you know how many degenerates are. You know how
somebody
many people
saw that and go, they screwed it up. I could perfect that.
You could do it better.
I could do that better.
I have $10,000 on this game. Just go take out player X's legs.
Because there's ways to cheat, and then there's like felonies. There's things that are going to put you in prison for a long time. That's one of those things. Tonya Harding's life has been in a downward spiral since then. I think last we checked, she's wrestling UFC.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, she's doing the MMA stuff. Not UFC, but MMA.
So is it safe to assume that if whatever your version of cheating was like a felony or a crime, it's going to land you on the worst?
These are just all-encompassing best and worst. So easiest to get away with, most effective, practical. Trying to break your competitor's legs with a steel pipe is none of those things. It's not effective. It's not practical. And it's pretty hard to get away with. Case in point, Tonya Harding. That's number five. Number four, fourth worst way to cheat in sports, lie about your age.
A lot of that going on right now, allegedly.
What do you mean?
Little League World Series.
Well, Danny Almonte is the one that everybody wants to point to. The kid's out there throwing like the equivalent of 97 miles per hour. He was in Little League. He was actually, what's the Little League age range to play Little League baseball?
I think the cap is like 13.
I think it might be 12. And he was 14. And he's out there just schooling these kids. He hit puberty a little bit earlier than everybody else, and he is just working them over. Shabazz Muhammad from UCLA got into a little bit of trouble with this. If you're an international basketball player, people are going to wonder. Or football. Ziggy Ansah who went to the Lions.
It happens all the time with baseball. People still question, like, with a Yasiel Puig or Yoenis Cespedes, people question if they're, like, 2 or 3 years older than they really are, because you mark down your age, you're going to get a lot more money.
And maybe there are guys floating around professional sports who did lie about their age and got away with it. I guess we'll never know. But for the most part, if you try to lie about it, like, they're going to find out, because I'm like 99.9% of people on this planet have a birth certificate.
Do you remember this one pitcher? I don't know what his name actually is. I think it's like Carlos Oviedo, but he went by Fausto Carmona.
Yes. It was just a couple years ago,
yeah,
right?
For the Indians. And then they found out it was a fake name. He was like 5 years older than he really was.
Don't knock the effort, but it's just not worth it. It's not worth the trouble, because then you're going to get blackballed. Is he playing?
I don't think so.
That's number four, lying about your age, the worst way to cheat. The third worst way to cheat in sports, faking an injury. This is mostly in football and mostly for defensive players. Teams running up tempo offense, you need to catch a breather, and your defensive coordinator's yelling at you, just get down. It was the Giants like 2 years ago, and there was clearly a coordinator yelling from the sidelines, like, go down with an injury, and two guys went down at the same time, and it was terrible. Like, one guy turns around, looks at the sideline to, like, get clarification, and then just drops to the ground like he fainted. It was just terrible acting. It hardly ever works, and it's just not worth the trouble. So faking an injury in football, the third worst way to cheat. Number two, recruiting violations. Mostly in basketball, but only because there is a poster child for it, and that would be one John Calipari.
Part of me wants to say this is actually a good way of cheating.
Why is that?
Well, it depends. Like, if you're a Kentucky basketball, you brought up Calipari, I don't think it's a smart idea. Like, you're Kentucky, you're going to be good anyway. But let's say you're Team X, you're terrible. Would you take 5 years of greatness of success if it caused some recruiting violations that down the road you got it, quote-unquote, taken away? But everybody knows
no,
it really
No, because what are you doing it for? What are you trying to get that level of success for? For bragging rights. To say, like, look at what we did, man. This made us so happy. Well, it's always going to have an asterisk next to it, and people are going to say, the only reason you were good is because you guys circumvented the rules. So I don't think it's worth it.
So you think if Memphis would have won the national championship in 08, if they would have actually beaten Kansas, that got taken away, wouldn't have meant anything.
Well, does it mean anything that they made it? I guess. I mean,
yeah.
Well, then it's not going to change. So, sure. But again, it would have a huge asterisk next to it. And people would say the only reason Memphis, of all places, was ever good at basketball is because they had to cheat. So.
I mean, do you care about USC with Reggie Bush?
No, that's a little bit different, though, right? That's one guy and him winning the Heisman. Maybe it's the same thing, but the list is final. Stop arguing it. Recruiting violations are the second worst way to cheat. And the worst way to cheat in all of sports, flopping in basketball. And you may say, really? There are things way more serious. There are things that are way more prevalent in sports. I disagree, because there's nothing more annoying in sports than guys flopping. The only people who seem to fall for it at this point are the actual guys who are the only people that matter are the referees, and they fall for it every time. I don't blame the guys for doing it, because if you can get away with it and they're not going to hold you accountable for it, why not? NBA cracking down, slapping guys with fines for flopping. I love it. It's the worst way to cheat in sports because it's so damn annoying. That's the worst way to cheat in sports. I'm Nick Schwartz. This is Let's Rank Stuff on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Let's get to the good stuff. The best ways to cheat in sports. Number five. This can be done by anybody of any age, casually changing the score in a pickup basketball game. Mm. You're playing to 21. You got 10 guys on the court. There's no scoreboard. You're just keeping track in your head. Somebody yells out, hey, what's the score? Somebody just scored a basket on the big down. Hey, what's the score? 14-11. Wait a minute. You guys just had 8. How'd you get to 11? No, wait. The whole game stops. No, wait. He scored a layup, and then we stole the ball. And it's so convoluted and confusing that people just go for it. 50% of the time it's going to work. If you're not changing the scores casually and pick up basketball, you're really not trying, and I don't want you on my team. Fifth best way to cheat in sports. Number four, in baseball, using a foreign substance. Phil Niekro using the emery board to keep his fingernails sharp for that knuckleball. Gaylord Perry with the spitball. You've got pine tar, George Brett. Who was the player? Clay Buchholz for Boston, who had the sunscreen in his hair, and he would wipe his hair, and it would doctor the ball.
I want to bring back Stick'Em in football.
Do you think that's cheating?
It is. They outlawed it.
Well, but they also have gloves now.
So?
I think gloves are probably more effective than Stick'Em.
No way.
No?
No.
You think if I had the gloves on and you had Stick'Em on, you would catch more balls than me? I don't know about that. But it sounds like...
Let's put it to a poll.
No, I don't think we need to put it to a poll when we can actually go out and do it. Do they still make Stick'Em?
Yeah, but you can have it on your hands.
Okay, I'll give you my credit card, buy it during the break, and we'll do it next week. Corking the bat, Sammy Sosa. Anything you can do to doctor the ball, any foreign substances that you can use in baseball, use them, man. It's funny. Love it. Fourth best way to cheat in sports. Number three, once again, this can apply to anybody at any level of any age. Utilizing the foot wedge... In golf. Stuck behind a tree? No problem. Just give it a little kick. When no one's looking, kick it out towards the fairway. Right? We're not playing the ball down today. One club length, right? Maybe two club lengths. Maybe three. Who's counting? Utilize the foot wedge as much as you possibly can. Golf's a great sport to cheat in because there's very few people who can hold you accountable. It's an individual sport. Not everybody's always paying attention to you. They've got their own things to worry about. How about throwing down a ball when you lose yours and no one else is looking? Just, you have one in your pocket and you kind of turn around. Oh, no one's looking. You just drop it. Oh, found it. Here it is. Lucky me, right next to the out of bounds marker. And then, of course, not finishing a putt.
a gimme in golf. That's another great one. Number two, spying. Bill Belichick knows all about this. This could include stealing signs in baseball, infiltrating practice sessions, having a mole on the inside, like the Cardinals, email hacking. If you can spy, you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. You ain't cheating, you ain't spying. Maybe, perhaps. Give it a run.
Rhymes make things true.
Spying, the second best way to cheat in sports. And the number one best way to cheat in sports. Taking steroids. That's right. There's no more effective way to cheat in sports than just shoving a needle into your buttocks. Get those hormones up. Get that T-ball, the testosterone going. The most important aspect of taking steroids, though, is lying about it afterwards. Because you will get caught. Ask Rafael Palmeiro. Ask Barry Bonds, Mark McGwire, Roger Clemens.
Barry Bonds hasn't been caught yet.
You got to lie about it afterwards. That's the only way to complete the full circle of cheating by taking steroids. That's Let's Rank Stuff. I'm Nick Schwert with Derek Johnson. It's Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. 1 hour down, two to go. Mitch Holtis at 4:15. Your Wednesday news break, but coming up next, big news coming out of the NBA last night. We'll share it with you on the other side.
This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
Your Wednesday news break coming up in 20 minutes. Jesse Newell of the KC Star at the top of the 5 o'clock hour. I'm Nick Schwert with Derek Johnson. This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Right now, let's welcome on our good friend, the voice of the Chiefs, Mitch Holtis, for his daily training camp reports. Mitch, what do you know, man?
Hey, we're just steamrolling ahead. Tomorrow's a big day. We have our big kickoff lunch, and I get to introduce 90 players to several thousand folks.
Heck yeah.
At the Sheraton, Kansas City, at Crown Center. Yep, and then we just sprint to the buses and head for Seattle.
Now, I ask you this every week, and it may seem a bit redundant, but I think it's still pertinent given the fact that there are dopes like me who just see, okay, it's the preseason's the preseason, then the regular season. But it's week three now. What changes this week for this team and this coaching staff?
No, it's not a dopey question at all, and there's no dopey questions, Nick. Just dopes who ask them. Okay,
thank you.
You got it. That's to flatter you. Quite honestly, yeah. Right. You imagine Bill said, "Yeah, Nick, he's just a dope." You know, he's a dope.
I can't imagine him saying that.
Oh yeah, probably happened the first news conference. but this has been to assimilate a regular season week as much as they can. The schedule they're on, this is an in-season Friday. Tomorrow's an in-season Saturday. And then the game would be as if it was a Sunday. So the veterans start to get into an in-season routine now. For the younger guys, they're still scrambling to get a spot, but not a lot of game planning into Seattle. But Andy Reid did say today, and I told you earlier in the week, he was kind of intimating that the starters would play first half and then roll through halftime and then play into the third quarter. Now, Andy has changed his template in the first two preseason games, so just put it in pencil, don't put it in ink, but that's kind of the plan. So it's much different in this game.
Now, I see that there's a few guys who are going to be sitting out this week. What can you tell us about the latest injury report?
Yeah, Shontavious Jones is on there, and that's, you know, he's right on the cut line. He's right on the bubble. He had a terrific block on the bubble screen touchdown that Mahomes threw to DeAnthony Thomas in Cincinnati. And that's something I mentioned about him, gosh, 3 weeks ago in these reports, that if you have a bigger receiver at the point of those bubble screens, it's much, you know, different than what the Chiefs have had in the past where they've got some smaller guys out there. But he's on the shelf. Parker Anger is back but won't play. Now, Andy Reid didn't rule out Eric Berry today. So, or Chris Jones. So that means maybe they'll get some time, but I think we just all kind of wait and see and wait and listen for Friday night. But the one that got me was Shontavious Jones, just because everything he can do or doesn't do at this point is watch very closely at wide receiver.
Can that work against a guy like him who's on the cut line, he's injured? How does the coaching staff take that into the equation?
Well, in the National Football League, and again, a lot of the focus on player safety, but it's the same for Free State or Lawrence High. I mean, the difference between hurt and being injured, or being sore and playing through something, or being seriously injured. Now, you got to rely on yourself and your body. You know your body better than anyone. You also rely on the athletic trainers and the team doctors. So, in this case, I mean, Shontavious is a tough guy. This is the biggest chance he's ever had at a Valdosta State of Division II school. But even, yes, even it can push him back, even if it puts him on a PUP list to start the season, or I doubt he'd go on the IR. You got to save two of those for IR designated to return. But it is so razor thin at that spot. Here's the other thing that works against him, Nick, is you're going, okay, well, Jones is out. We'll just keep five wide receivers and four tight ends instead of six wide receivers and three tight ends. It's not just your position in the numbers game of the NFL. It is the numbers, even offense to defense, and how you're going to allocate your players. Because, again, there's only 53 players and only 46 are active on any given Sunday. Lawrence High and Free State will play with much more guys in their opening game than the Chiefs will on any given Sunday.
Kareem Hunt, 8 carries, 40 yards against Cincinnati this past weekend, but it seemed like he was finding ways to impact the game other than when he had the ball in his hands. What did you think of his performance?
Well, the best play he's had in the preseason is his blitz pickup, a fire pass. The Chiefs call it something else. A fire pass is when the fullback goes, oh, I'm going to block, and then he slips out into the flat. It's a great red zone play. But if you do that, that means the fullback is not blocking. And so somebody better block the guys the fullbacks are supposed to block. And in this case, Kareem Hunt took out two guys. One thing that was overlooked in the game, and kind of looking at the analysis of both professionals and just fans alike, I don't think they realize how much Cincinnati blitzed in that game. They blitzed more than your normal preseason game, and that usually early in the season could spell doom. But the Chiefs did a great job of picking up blitzes, and it was an awesome sign for Hunt to not only read the blitz and recognize it, but to take two guys out. That's a fourth and one play. The Chiefs don't get any points out of that drive if Hunt doesn't make that block or blocks, blocking two guys at once.
Is that running back depth chart starting to shake itself out a little bit?
Well, just put it on a flat line. It's like a line item. I know everybody wants an ABC or a 1-2-3 because they want to know for fantasy football. If you need a sneaky fantasy pick, take Hunt or Spiller. But I'm telling you, the way Andy works, and I've watched him for 4 years, it may be Spencer Ware's day, and next week it's Hunt. Or the third one, it's Spiller. All three can contribute on any single game. Joe McKnight won the Miami game in 2014,
right,
Reclamating his career. And then he tore his knee up. In that game, he ran two circle routes for touchdowns. That and the three tight end alignment that Andy dreamt up during the week because the Chiefs were so beat up won that game. But did you have Joe McKnight on your fantasy team?
I did not.
If you did, you probably won your league because nobody else is going to have him. But that's what with the Chiefs, you just have to do it week by week. If you're in a fantasy league, just keep following the Chiefs really closely. And then hopefully you can make the necessary roster adjustment because it's not 1, 2, or 3. It's a flat line with those guys.
Okay, from a real football standpoint, no fantasy talk. From a real football standpoint, is there value in handling your running backs like that in terms of keeping opponents guessing, not knowing exactly who's going to get the lion's share of the carries on any given week?
Yes, because in the National Football League, the less predictable you can be, the big advantage you've got. And because the NFL, different than college football, I know college coaches are going, wait a minute, is it that difference? Yes, there is. Because they'll know when you leave your house and when you go home and when you floss your teeth and, you know, who your third cousin is. So if you're predictable, you'll get washed away. And so if the Chiefs have three different guys that can approach you, the only way you get in trouble with that is if they scout you and they know, uh-oh, this guy means this 10 plays. But Andy doesn't do that. But sometimes, and particularly in college, you'll see this. If Nick Schwartz coming into the game, oh, well, this narrows it down to these 12 plays. But Andy won't do that with these three guys. Plus, you've got some power with Spiller. You got some ability to miss and yards after contact from Spencer Ware. And you got both of that with Kareem Hunt.
Is Andy Reid one of the more unpredictable coaches in the NFL?
Absolutely. And don't ask me, ask the opponents. When you get in the off season and you go to some NFL meeting or whatever, you run into people it's just a casual time, they're going to go, God, that dude, you cannot figure out what he's going to do. He does not give you any tendencies, because they'll say, well, the bye week, you know, we study our tendencies and we don't want to be tentacle, you know. But Andy does that all the time. So he makes sure he never gets into a rut on certain down and distance in certain situations.
We're talking to the voice of the Chiefs, Mitch Holthus, here on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. If you were to go into a lab and create the perfect wide receiver for this Chiefs offense, would you come out with somebody looking like Tyreek Hill?
Well, probably wouldn't at the beginning, and then I would go, lab is shut down, because this, whoever made this lab, whoever lab made this guy, I'm going to go apply for work with them. I think he's broken the mold here a little bit. I think he's way different than anything the Chiefs have had, and I'm not sure the NFL has had a lot like him. Again, he's kind of a combination. He's a Sproles, but he runs really good routes, and he's a receiver. I just find this fascinating. And one thing I'm talking about, I've talked about Chris Conley a lot over the last month, too. I think this is a very big game for him. I was looking back. Conley's only been targeted 30 times on third downs and has 12 receptions in 2 years for first downs on third downs. You look at Tyreek Hill's ratio, when he had 61 catches last year on something like 81 targets. What if you target him 160, or just, are you going to get 100 catches? You maybe got 100, 110 catches in the guy. And that means 12 or 1,300 yards, and that means he's going to go the distance most of the time. If he stays healthy, and this works the way I've seen it working, I said this before, but by Columbus Day, you're going to see people going crazy about this guy. Because, honestly, in this day and age, reality football follows fantasy football. Kid you not. Because, oh, ESPN, you know, the Raiders are the greatest team of all time in April. If Hill blows up, you're going to start seeing all kinds of Tyreek Hill talk, because people are winning their fantasy league with him.
Well, when you look at this receiving core, okay, Tyreek Hill, how many guys in the league are faster than him? Maybe none.
Ooh.
Chris Conley, what runs a 4.3. Yeah. Travis Kelce, how many tight ends in the league are you going to see coaches run bubble screens for? Like, this has to be not just the fastest unit that Alex Smith's had around him, maybe that Andy Reid's had around him. Find me a faster collection of pass catchers in the NFL. I don't think you can do it.
No. Gosh, Cincinnati's bunch last week isn't bad. When they get John Ross up and going, he ran a 4.22 at the combine, an all-time record. And then you got A.J. Green, Brandon LaFell, who's more of the possession guy. But still, I mean, that's one that comes to mind. But to your point, and I don't want to overstate this, and I get excited and people go, he's just the old Holthus hyperbole. I would tell you this is by far the fastest group I've been around in 24 years. I'm not sure it's even close. I don't even have another team to put in this category, because you're forgetting DeAnthony Thomas.
Right, yeah.
I mean, he's gonna be in your 4x1, and people don't even talk about that dude. And so the running backs we mentioned aren't blazers, but they're fast enough. There's quick and fast. And if you've got really fast around quick and fast, the two help each other.
Well, I just think you've got unicorns. We talked on Monday about how Hill and Kelce complement each other. There's nobody at that position who's built and play like those two guys play around the rest of the league.
No, Gronkowski would come to mind, but he's more of a, you know, he's a bigger, more powerful Kelce.
Yeah.
But he's not going to beat a corner on a route on a nine. He'll overpower a corner or safety. But Travis Kelce is a wide receiver and a tight end body.
Yeah, the Patriots game, what was it, 2 years ago, or maybe it was last year, they run that screen for Kelce. I go, I've never seen a team do that with their tight end before.
No, and the Bronco game last year, like first yep. two plays of the game, it's like 70 yards and gone. And like, that's the tight end? Like, what's the story with this guy? I mean, and then Tyreek Hill's just, you know, a freak. I don't know where he came from. I think he's Bill Self's favorite Chiefs player, though. I'm going to tell you the truth.
Really?
Yep. Ask Bill Self. Well, he'll nip on you if you get in the right situation and go, what do you think of Tyreek Hill? See what he says and let me know.
I will. I'll report back to you on that, too. We got Mitch Holthus, voice of the Chiefs, new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. What are we up to, Derek? 66-0, Mitch, so far.
Yeah, by the way, let's stop. Have you read Our Boys? Where are you at in the book?
We talked about this yesterday. I'm making slow progress. I'm a slow reader, but I'm going on vacay. I got a 3-hour flight tomorrow, and that thing is going to be read completely by the time I land in Wisconsin tomorrow afternoon.
You're the guy that is standing outside of like Strong Hall asking for an extension on the class.
No, every I'm going up class. To my classmates trying to borrow their notes.
Sick. Yeah, you're borrowing their notes, but you've already taken the final, but you're going, I think I'm sick. I don't. My grandma's not feeling good. My dog ran away. What else we got? What else they got? I mean,
I've used
all
those.
Six of your grades are incomplete. I get it. I want a whole report on this, buddy. I need to know.
Well, you know, and that's the problem with the school system, Mitch, is they try to compact all this stuff into a short amount of time, and then kids just cram, and they don't retain any of the information. I like to take my time. I like to go back, reread sections, make sure I'm absorbing all of this information. Don't you think that's the proper way to go about it?
That's brilliant, because you can rationalize anything, and that sounds as good as anything I've heard today.
Thank you.
For the last hour.
I'll take that as a compliment. 66-0, Gino Auriemma territory. You ready to give it a shot?
Yeah, but I think I got better hair than he does, but I don't know.
Way better hair. Don't even.
Yeah, that hair's got to go.
Absolutely.
It's got to do something, man. Okay, here we go.
Northern Heights.
Northern Heights Wildcats. Black and white. Love that field. It sets up in the Flint Hills on high ground. Might have been the site of my son's first high school touchdown. But the question is it Northern Heights or is it Allen? Or is it Redding? Or is it Americus? Ah, gosh, who am I leaving out that goes there? Miller, or all these little towns that go there for the Northern Heights Wildcats?
Hoisington.
Hoisington Cardinals. Here you go. You remember Tyrell Reed, right?
Of course.
Jimmy Jayhawk.
Burlington.
His daddy. Yep. But his daddy was a stud for the Hoisington Cardinals.
Stacy Reed.
Stacy
Reed. Oh, yeah.
Stacy
all about
Reed
him.
Could ball. Yep. And then Hoisington, one of the blessings was, they had a prom night and a terrible tornado hit that town, and it wasn't prom. They got moved it, actually, thank the grace of God. They got it away from the side of the tornado. They just did it because of, you know, just good fortune and grace. But anyway, the Hoisington Cardinals have had some players now. They're right there just north of Great Bend, and they'll bring it.
Olpe,
the Eagles of Olpe. Best known when you read your book. Probably best known for their role in Our Boys. But you haven't read the book, so we can't have a conversation on the Olpe Eagles, because somehow, I'm not going to give you the cliff notes so you can cheat on the test, somehow the Olpe Eagles will bring it up again next week when
okay.
you read the book.
Okay. Promise I will.
Okay.
Center High School.
The Center Cougars. Center High School. Now, is it Tampa? Yes, Tampa's in Kansas. You didn't know that, did you?
I didn't.
Is it Lincolnville? Gosh, what else? Durham, I think, either goes there now. Or Durham was a power in the early 60s in basketball, double B basketball. Galen Frick played at K-State. Let's see, what else? With really good baseball players came out of Center High School. Highway 77, but again, another one of those schools where four or five little towns make up the school. Gosh, they had who came out of there? Hollabs. Were really good baseball players that came out of there. So the Poppies were great softball players that came out of Center High School. I think they played at K-State, Emporia State. But anyway, really good school, and yep, the Center Cougars. C-E-N-T-R-E to you, by the way.
That's right.
Not C-E-N-T-E-R, that if you read the Our Boys book, you'll see that's what Smith Center is spelled, but not Center, C-E-N-T-R-E.
Up to 70-0. So we'll stop comparing you to Gino Auriemma. I'll start making some John Wooden references. You more comfortable with that one?
Yes, but I'll give you my pyramid of success.
Okay.
I'll just give you the top of the deal. One, eat Papa John's pizza at 9th and Mississippi.
That's a given.
That's in the first little square at the top, right, from Bruce Collinsworth. Two, read Our Boys. Once you get those two things done, if you do them simultaneously, then you'll see the whole pyramid of success come right in front of your eyes and soul.
Not many people know this. I'm actually in a book club with Bruce Collinsworth.
Ooh.
And we just started it a couple weeks ago. Our Boys, first on the reading list. Imagine that.
There you go. Okay.
Appreciate you, Mitch. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you guys.
All righty.
Yes,
that's the voice of the Chiefs, Mitch Holtis. I'm Nick Schwert. It's Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
Well, Jesse, it seems like the dust is starting to settle a little bit on Mitchell Robinson, and the more the time goes by, it seems pretty unlikely he's going to end up in a KU uniform next year.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think this is kind of the sense you got. Gary Bedore talked to Bill Self at, you know, Introductions Night, Traditions Night, on Sunday night at Memorial Stadium, and you kind of got the feeling from that when Bill Self said he didn't expect to sign any players to fill that scholarship, that that was the way it was headed. And there's been some reports after that, you know, Pat Forty of Yahoo, I think Matt Norlander of CBS has kind of jumped in on that, all these ones. But, you know, I think this, all this was contingent upon KU figuring out or finding a way for Mitchell Robinson to be eligible this year. So it seemed like there was always maybe that glimmer of hope that they could figure out a way to do it. But as time went on, he didn't make that KU decision right away, and the days became a week, and it kind of kept trailing on and on. You kind of figured that maybe something else was going to happen here. But, you know, looking at it from a big picture perspective, I don't know that this is a horrible thing for Mitchell Robinson. You know, he's projected to be a lottery pick next year. Sometimes guys get higher stock when they don't play that much. You know, you see kind of the unknown factor where you don't get a bunch of your weaknesses picked apart. Instead, you're kind of the guy that nobody really knows about and everybody still thinks has a high ceiling. So I can understand why you'd want to do this. I can see where this would be an attractive option. It's just for KU to have spent the resources and time to recruit him and have that come up empty, especially in the roster situation they're in. Has to be disappointing, but that's what you get when it's this point in the year and you have a guy like Jack Whitman leave so late. There's just only so many options out there. And so Mitchell Robinson for a couple days looked like an ideal place for ideal fit for KU. If you could be eligible right away, it just looks like that's not going to turn out.
Well, when we first heard that he was decommitting from Western Kentucky, I kind of said on the show, I said, you got to make a call, right? You've got an empty roster spot. You can use some depth in the front court, and he would provide even more than depth. He would be a game changer if he were to be eligible to play. But I think even at the time, we knew it was kind of a pie-in-the-sky sort of situation. Like, if they were able to have this guy fall into their lap at the 11th hour, it would be the most fortunate circumstances that you could imagine. So, with that being said, it shouldn't come as much of a surprise. And is it really that disappointing knowing that it was unlikely from the get-go?
Well, I think what happened was, and this is understandable because of the time of the year, it just checked every single box when it comes to a guy getting a bunch of buzz, a bunch of recruiting fanfare, fans going wild. I mean, everybody, you know, I was in Italy and covering the team on exhibition games, you know, and they're playing games and showing what they can do, and there's half the team is newcomers, so there should be excitement. And the most frequent question I'm getting is about Mitchell Robinson. I mean, it just kind of checked every single box that would make this a story that would completely blow up on social media, online, just that he was kind of a McDonald's All-American, a top prospect, kind of a late guy that KU wouldn't have figured that they could have gotten. The scholarship is open. KU has a spot for him in that position. He's, like you said, he's got the intrigue of a guy who might be able to play right away. So all these things kind of lined up to make this just a totally, for lack of a better term, buzzworthy story. And so there's just been all this hype around Mitchell Robinson the last 3 weeks. So I think there just is a natural letdown. You're right. I mean, this isn't a loss for the KU basketball program. This isn't a big defeat when it comes to recruiting. It's just that the hype and the buzz is built up so high that I think now there's kind of just a natural crash a little bit that KU fans were thinking and hoping and dreaming that this guy would end up on campus and playing alongside Udoka Azubuike and filling in that big man role that KU needs for this year's team. And that's just not going to happen now. So I think that everything just kind of came together for this to become a story that was much bigger than maybe ever should have been. But again, that's what we are in today's college basketball. The unknown is better than the known. I mean, Mitchell Robinson is the 8th ranked recruit. Billy Preston's the 10th ranked recruit. Nobody's talking about Billy Preston right now. They're all talking about Mitchell Robinson because he's the one that's not on campus. So all those things just kind of came together to make a story that kind of spiraled into something that was pretty huge. And so now it's just kind of dealing with the reality that, hey, KU has a pretty good team this year. I think I saw in ESPN's rankings they're preseason ranked number 3. I mean, Bill Self and company will still be fine as long as they can avoid both the injury bug and suspensions and all those sorts of things, because their top 7 players are still pretty darn good.
He's Jesse Newell of the Kansas City Star joining us here on Rock Chalk Sports Talk. With that being said, Mitchell Robinson now looks likely that he's not even going to play college ball next year. He could still go overseas and make some money. He could sit out if that's what he wants to do. Do you think there's a lesson to be learned from his situation, how he handled it, committing to Western Kentucky, a program he probably never would have considered under normal circumstances? Now he's kind of lost himself for a year. What, if any, lessons are to be learned from his situation?
You know, I don't know, and I'm not sure we're going to know until we see where he's drafted, because I just keep thinking about what happens in draft season, and you know, you see a guy like Sue Mykhailiuk, and it's funny. I looked at the latest Draft Explorer / I guess they're now connected with ESPN and the mock drafts that are coming out. You know, the first mock drafts of the season, and I was curious to see who the number one KU player was that was going to be taken on this mock draft. Can you guess who it was?
I'm going to guess it is Udoka.
Udoka wasn't on there. That would have been my guess.
Okay, then Malik.
A couple months back, it actually was Sue Mykhailiuk. And so
where'd they have him
going?
It's
crazy to me because what happens here? I mean, and again, you kind of understand the psychology of it. It's the natural. What happened with Sue last year was he played a season. He had a disappointing season. He struggled late in the year, especially defensively. You know, people thought he might lose his starting spot. And all along, he'd been a draft prospect, but all those question marks came up. Okay, they'd just seen him play. He hadn't done that well, all those things. And basically, he told anybody who would listen, it sounded like from the reports we got, that if he was a second-round pick, if he was going to be drafted, he would keep his name in the NBA draft. He basically got the information that he wasn't going to get drafted. Okay? So fast forward here. Now, what is it, 6 months later? I mean, we've seen him again. We've seen him look better in 4 exhibition games against overmatched teams in Italy. What has changed with Sue Mykhailiuk that now makes him the 33rd pick in the draft, other than a completely different draft class? I will give you that. But what's changed is he hasn't played in 6 months. You know, everybody hasn't had the time to come and pick apart his tape and have that negative momentum with him and think that he's not maybe what people thought he was and all those things. And so, again, I don't know the lesson to be learned yet, because maybe Mitchell Robinson's going to open up a whole new avenue where people realize that, hey, if I don't go play college basketball for a year and I don't expose all the weaknesses I have and I don't have all these NBA scouts picking apart what I can't do instead of what I can do, maybe this is the road for me to have a higher draft pick. We've seen this happen in other instances with overseas players as well, where they get a little bit overhyped just because people don't know as much about them. So you imagine the ceiling instead of dreading about the floor. So I guess we'll see. I don't know the answer to that. And, you know, frankly, I'm not sure, and this is probably a lot part of a larger discussion, but forcing every basketball player who wants to go to the NBA to college, you know, I don't know that that's the right solution either. It seems like there might be room out there for players who just feel like that's not the best fit for them, or even if it's just not wanting to go to school or just wanting to focus on their pro career, all those sorts of things. So we'll see how this all turns out. But, yeah, the Western Kentucky thing for him just seemed, like you said, just still, it seemed ill-conceived. And then once he wanted to leave as soon as he did, he really was left out of options unless that waiver came through. So it'll be fascinating to track, because I do want to see what happens to his stock from this point forward. Will he drop? When he move up, we just don't know, but there have been very few instances like this to kind of study and see what happens.
That's a very interesting point that you made. So, like, when you view this situation in its totality with Mitchell Robinson, like, is your natural reaction to look at Robinson as a product of the system that isn't really set up to help these kids succeed?
I don't know if he's the perfect example. You know, I could see more of some students just aren't meant to go to college. You know, I mean, there's plenty of people that we know that was not their life choice. They wanted to go out and be in military or go straight to the workforce. And I'm just saying, the path to go to the NBA right now, as most people see it, is you have to get to college, and then, you know, how you get to college sometimes seems to be one of the shady things about recruiting and schools and getting you into the university and getting you admitted and all those sorts of things, getting the test scores that are needed. I don't think that Mitchell Robinson is the case of that, because, you know, he was at Western Kentucky. He was available to go there. He started summer school, all those sorts of things. I'm just saying, I don't think pigeonholing every single player who thinks he's an NBA player into college is necessarily the right move. And, you know, we've seen just limited examples of this. Some guys have gone overseas for a year and then played professionally. But it just always seems like this can create problems, that because the best basketball players in the world who want to go to the NBA, who want to get exposure, feel like they have to go to college, that's where you can see maybe some of the corruption in the sport getting through, because those guys have to get to college somehow, and you have to get them in. And so you can see where things might go a little bit awry to try to get these kids to college when that might not be the case. But I don't think that was the case with Mitchell Robinson. But this is a path, again, this is a path not taken very often with him. He's going to sit out a year. Is he going to stay in shape? Is he going to work out with a trainer? Is he going to try to go play in leagues? I mean, what's he going to do to stay ready for the NBA draft? That's the major question, I think, moving forward. And like I said, it'll be a fascinating case scenario, because if this does work for him, he's the 7th pick overall. I mean, you could see a lot more guys in the future saying, look, if I don't expose myself and all my weaknesses out there in college basketball and get myself beat up in practices for 6 months, maybe I can increase my stock. And for these kids, and their future. That's really what's most important, is trying to figure out what's best for them and the best financial future that they can have.
He's Jesse Newell of the Kansas City Star. I'm Nick Schwartz. It's Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. I want to switch gears and talk some football with you. Next weekend will be game number one for year three of the David Beatty era. And even though the quarterback situation seems to be a little bit more optimistic than it has been in his first 2 years, it seems like he's handling it similarly in the fact that he's not going to give an edge to the competitor. He's not going to let anybody know any insight into who's got that edge in the quarterback race. Do you think there is inherent value in waiting as long as possible before releasing who's going to be the starting quarterback?
I do to an extent, but maybe not as far as KU football is pushing it. I think the value of it for college football teams is, if you keep that competition going, it's much less likely that your backup decides to transfer. And so I think if you want to be safe, and I think KU likes Carter Stanley, you know, and I'm assuming he's going to be the backup start of the year. I'm assuming Peyton Bender's going to start out so long. You don't bring in a JUCO quarterback if you think he's going to sit. They've said positive things about Peyton Bender. He's played in the air raid under Mike Leach at Washington State. I was shocked if he's not the starter. I mean, like, every sign, every indication points to Peyton Bender being the starting quarterback for Kansas. But if you don't announce that and you say it's an open competition, you know, it's more likely that your backup stays around and that he gets through the season. And then you have a backup quarterback. And we've seen with Kansas the last few years. I mean, your backup could play in the first game. He could play in the second game. More than likely, he's going to play by the third game. I mean, that's the way that injuries have happened. That's the way performances happen. And so kind of locking that up, I think, is kind of part of this mental game that KU is playing right now. But having said that, I don't know that there's a danger with that in Carter Stanley. I guess it's better safe than sorry, but Carter Stanley and Peyton Bender are roommates, so they kind of have a different relationship than you'd expect with two competing quarterbacks. And again, just from talking with Carter Stanley and kind of knowing him, I just don't see him as the type that would go off and pout and leave the program once he would maybe not be named the starter. I mean, the kid had two Division I offers out of high school. One of them was UConn, one of them was Kansas. I mean, KU showed him some loyalty when nobody else really was, and I think he likes his experience at Kansas. Again, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I don't think he would have a problem with being the backup quarterback, especially if Peyton Bender was it. As far as surprising Southeast Missouri State, I mean, sure, I guess. I put that more in the hogwash category. Listen, Southeast Missouri State's great. They're a great Division I program. I know they haven't had a winning season, I think, in the last 3 years under the new coach that they've had. They're going to come in and compete hard. They almost beat Kansas a couple years ago. I understand all these things. But, you know, if you need to be coy and have a quarterback controversy question mark situation to beat Southeast Missouri State at home, where you're probably going to be 4-touchdown favorites, you got bigger problems in your program. So, to me, there are benefits to it. I don't think that the stated benefit is to benefit KU against Southeast Missouri State necessarily. But if you want to keep the best quarterbacks you have in the program, I could see a reason why you'd want to get this thing and keep it going as long as possible. But, again, let's talk real here. I will be shocked if Peyton Bender's not starting quarterback for Kansas in game one and if he's not the guy for every single possession when it's a close game. So I think most people feel that way. I think most people assume that. And so even if they don't come out right out and say it, I think that that's basically the reality of the situation.
Well, I know you well enough at this point, Jesse, that you're not going to tell me if you feel good about a team, if you're digging their vibes for this season, but you are numbers guys. So looking at this team, what they did a year ago, what they've got coming in this season, are you bullish on this team? Do you think this is a year where they do take a tangible step up and rack up more than just a win or two?
I think so. Here's what I keep saying to people when it comes to this, is that there's progression to be made without KU just completely turning its whole program around. I mean, KU's offense has been worst in scoring offense in the Big 12 the last seven seasons. In that seven seasons, KU, you know, all these teams are running the air raid, they're running fast tempo, they're scoring, they're going up and down the field. You know, Texas Tech averages 50 points a game. KU has never averaged more than 23 points a game in that seven-year stretch. I mean, that is crazy. That is remarkable. How does that happen? And so, again, that's kind of the point I'm at, which is KU's offense doesn't need to become a top half of the Big 12 offense under Doug Meacham, which he's basically done every single year. He was the co-offensive coordinator at TCU. It needs to go from awful to sort of bad. You know what I mean? Like, it needs to go, what if KU averaged 26 points a game? I mean, I know scoring offense isn't always the best measure. You know, tempo goes into that, possession. Trust me, I get all that. But
at the same point, 23 points per game is 23 points per game. If you're not scoring more than that, you're not going to win many games. So, again, the same thing. KU's quarterback situation since Todd Reesing has been just downright awful. I mean, you go down the line, Jake Heaps, Dane Chris, I mean, all these guys just not working out, and KU never having consistency at position, maybe other than Jordan Webb for a couple games and Michael Cummings before he got hurt for a few games. Other than that, it's just been a complete wasteland. So, again, Peyton Bender doesn't have to come in and set the world on fire. He just has to not be last place in the Big 12 in total QBR like every KU quarterback of the last six seasons. You know, so just incremental improvements. Offensive line, I mean, those guys being together, having experience, played together, getting those guys starts next to each other, is that going to help? Can that kind of give incremental improvement? And so that, to me, that's kind of where I am. But, you know, the bottom line, Dave Beatty will tell you this, improvements and all these things are measured in victories. And so if you're looking at KU's schedule, the first six games are where they can get victories, and especially the, you know, the first two are so important to start 2-0 and then see what you can do from that point on. So at home against Southeast Missouri State, at home against Central Michigan, those are the two biggest games of the season, and also where KU football will have the whole attention of the KU fan base because, you know, like it or not, it's before basketball season. So if you start 2-0, if you start 3-1, you get a little bit of buzz going, you can kind of create some of that momentum and keep people interested. If you start 1-3, it's going to drop off pretty quickly with late night coming in late September. So it'll be fascinating to watch to see how well this KU team does early and see how much buzz they can generate if they can just go from, in a lot of categories, from really bad to just, hey, kind of sort of bad or even average. That'd be a really big upgrade.
Jesse, you know firsthand that I'm terrible at making bets. I seem to have a penchant for punishing myself with this kind of stuff, but a very interesting proposition came across my desk yesterday. The likelihood that Mark Mangino will be brought to tears next Saturday when he's being honored by the University of Kansas. What would you handicap that line at?
So you have a line in front of you?
No, I don't have a line. You're kind of
You want to create a line.
Yeah, I want you to help me create a line.
I'm going -200, no tears. I think it's 2-1, no tears.
I think so, too.
I think he's a tough guy. I think he's going to keep it together.
So you think...
What do you think?
Well, I think so, too. But the last time I was assured that nobody would cry, Frank Mason was not just brought to tears, but, I mean, he wept.
I was going to say, that was when you lost an eyebrow, right?
No, I have to shave my head. And as a matter of fact...
Oh, okay.
As a matter of fact, I've been putting it off because my best friend's getting married this weekend. I actually leave tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So after that wedding... The clock starts ticking. I have to get the head shaved before KU starts the basketball season. So I was so sure that Frank Mason wasn't going to cry. So would you have said at the time more likely Mangino would be brought to tears than Frank Mason on senior night?
This is hindsight, of course. I probably would have said Frank Mason just because of what he'd been through at Kansas. And the tears with Mark Mangino, I mean, it would have to be a genuine spot just from the fans, just because you know that he feels like he's been mistreated by KU. Even if those people aren't in power right now, you would feel like the emotional attachment he would have would be to the fans and the standing ovation he would get. And so I still think it would be less likely for Mangino, and just based on his temperament too, you know, kind of the tough guy and keeping things together. But anything's possible, and him coming back, it could be a very emotional moment for him. There's no doubt about that.
You're presenting a very convincing argument. I've got a week to mull it over, but I'll let you know what I end up going with.
Okay. I'll go no tears Mangino. Put me on that side. Obviously, I just said the betting line was 2-1, so I would put myself on that.
All right, we're going to put that line out there and see if it gets any action, and we'll see if it moves between now and next Saturday.
Sounds good.
Hey, thanks for the time, Jesse.
Yeah, no problem, and I need Twitter pics of the shaved head, or it didn't happen.
You'll get it. Don't worry. And you'll see me in person, but yes, I'll put them out there for the whole world to see.
Sounds good.
All right, thanks again.